If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably a clinical nurse who is driven and curious. You may be commuting or cleaning the house and just want to maximize that time to learn and to be the best, most informed nurse you can be for your patients. I started this podcast 2.5 years ago to help you do just that. With over 40 episodes in the books, my guests and I have covered topics which started with nasogastric tubes, then on to dialysis, vasopressors, figuring out what the heck interventional radiology is, neutropenic fever, and the list goes on. As 2022 comes to a close and I reflect, I've asked myself, what were the best moments of this podcast in the last 2.5 years? What could be the most high-yielding, practice-improving episode that I could hack together for my listeners? In this episode, I will share with you what I have considered to be my biggest aha moments, those that have influenced my practice on just about a daily basis. Welcome to Up My Nursing Game, the educational nursing podcast that uses expert interviews to address common nursing questions and pitfalls. I am your host, Annie Fulton. I'm going to start out here with a segment that has really helped me wrap my head around ostomies. While there ended up being a whole episode dedicated to ostomies, which is episode 40, early on in episode 2, Brittany Hung, who is a nurse practitioner and certified wound and ostomy nurse, introduced and framed the topic in such a way that has really helped me approach my patients with ostomies.
When these patients with a urostomy present to the hospital, will they often bring their own urostomy pouch?
We like to tell people before they're discharged from their original surgery, always have pouches with you. That's not always the case, but your hospital is not going to carry every single pouch, every single manufacturer. They may not even have a convex pouching system, which is a common thing that you would use if the stoma does not stick out from the skin. I know our hospital doesn't carry them right now. So we really encourage people to bring their own supplies until we can figure out if our supplies work for them or we can order supplies. But if we special order supplies, they might not come until the patient's already discharged. So oftentimes these patients will need to bring their own supplies and will need to be using them throughout the stay.
Yeah. And as a bedside nurse, I think this can be a little bit intimidating that often you become very comfortable with whatever your hospital supplies, but just ask the patient, you know, if they're with it enough that they bring their own supplies and maybe they've had this urostomy, colostomy for a while, they can tell you all about it.
Yeah, or the family can tell you. The family, if the patient can't tell you, the family will know so much about that stoma. And right now, with our COVID precautions and not allowing family members in, the family members really appreciate the phone call because they are worried that, you know, the skin's going to break down while the patient's in the hospital, or they know that stoma like the back of their hand, and they know exactly what that stoma needs. So they can bring in the supplies and they can tell you over the phone how to do the pouch change too.
I miss having families at bedside. I never thought I'd say that.
Ever since Brittany and I spoke, I've shifted my thinking of ostomies away from feeling like I need to know 100% of everything about a patient's ostomy to first and foremost, just asking the patient and letting the patient or family drive ostomy management. I would say most of the time, my young to middle-aged patients are managing their ostomies by themselves. They're emptying it, they're changing it out on their own. But, you know, sometimes it's not that simple. So, for example, there was one time I was endorsed by night shift that my patient's ostomy was leaking and, you know, just generally problematic. So after I, you know, introduced myself to the patient, got to know them a little bit, I asked them, do you have your home supply? Which they didn't. So I called the family who brought in the ostomy supplies with a wonderfully detailed set of instructions that I followed, and wham bam, we had a perfectly functioning ostomy bag. I guess if I can convey anything to you here, it's that if the ostomy bag isn't working, don't try this, that, and the other. Don't try to reapply with paste. Don't call central supply to find a million different things. Instead, ask the patient, what do you do at home? Can we get your home supply? That should lead you to success a vast majority of the time. Moving on from ostomies and in no particular order, I'm going to talk about pain management. So pain, for me, is always a bit of a stressor because I feel this tug between wanting to provide relief and get my patients comfortable while not wanting to stumble onto the negative effects of narcotics such as over-sedation, dependence, constipation, you know, all of that bad stuff associated with opioids. So it's a balancing act for sure. I brought Jason Lowe onto the podcast to help me and my audience make sense of pain management. He is also, like Brittany, a nurse practitioner, but Jason is also the head advanced practitioner on the pain team at his hospital. So listen as he explains the multimodal approach to pain management.
One thing I see a lot now that I'm working in a hospital with, you know, with a pain service is this multimodal approach where I'll see patients who are on, like, I don't know, maybe even up to 5 different pain medications, and only one or two of them for like breakthrough pain are opiates. And it's been really interesting for me to learn. I've gotten like a crash course on like, you know, opiate alternatives. I guess I'll call them that because I don't really know the exact term for them. But, you know, medications to bring down pain like Tylenol or gabapentin, or in like the acute post-operative period, like I'll see a lot of nerve blocks and what else? Epidurals. So I was wondering if you could just talk like briefly about this like multimodal approach for pain management.
Yeah, thank you. I'm actually glad you brought up this multimodal strategy we use at my institution. Also, many, many institutions are doing the same thing right now. Multimodal is just stand for multiple modality. That means that you use more than one type of medication, or maybe the same type of medication, but different route of it, IV, intravenous route, oral route, transdermal route, or that you use a different timing for the medication, that use every 12 hours on, 12 hours off. So different type, different route, different medication. With the thought is that given this different modality approach, that we're able to use less of the of one monotherapy, and then so that we have less side effects of the smaller dose of each medication. And each route or medication modality can potentially bring down the point, bring down the pain by a little bit, 1 to 2 points. With 5 different routes, 5 different medications, 5 different types of modality, if they can bring down 5 to 6 points, a pain point, that would be the almost a 50% improvement of pain control. This is something that we are aiming for. Each alone can bring down a point by 1 point medication. And then we can bring the pain quite significantly lower. But because we use one medication, and we use more than one medication, we do not really jump up on each medication. So those are pretty low. The side effects of it are pretty low as well. So almost negligible to use the side effects. Like if you have Tylenol 1 gram instead of 4 gram a day, we can really like not even have to worry about the liver issue. And we use the NSAID. If we do not assess certain doses a day, we can even eliminate the risk of bleeding, not to say completely eliminate, but like not to worry too much about bleeding. Imagine that each drug being used as a solo therapy, we need a lot of it to get to the point of a 50% decrease of pain control. So that alone is a very new approach we're using now. We have done studies and evidence and research that it really works, does bring down how much lower of opiate being consumed when you're a multimodal regimen.
Okay, so why did I find this explanation so enlightening? With this multimodal framework in mind, I've been able to explain to my patients who are in, you know, a 10 out of 10 pain, why they should take Tylenol, why they should use a lidocaine patch, and why they should give gabapentin a chance. Patients who are in severe pain often need some encouragement not to rely on opiate monotherapy to provide relief. I so frequently find myself explaining to my patient, for example, who's in, you know, severe postoperative pain, look, I realize that taking Tylenol may seem useless when you're in this much pain, but what we're doing with all these medications is approaching the pain in different ways so that each medication can bring your pain down by some. Depending on the patient, I may go further to explain the benefits, if fewer side effects, and less dependence on opioids. But in general, I've definitely been able to sell my patients on taking non-opioids, even when they're in severe pain, since I learned about the theory behind the multimodal approach with Jason. Okay, moving on. Everybody's favorite, cardiac arrest. Yes, I don't know why we like this so much, but I asked my BLS instructor, Al Zhuk, to speak on the podcast because I wanted to have the opportunity to step outside the algorithms, which don't do a whole lot, at least for me, to help me understand the pathophys of what's going on, to talk about BLS and ACLS in a more conversational way. So listen in as he walks me through what exactly constitutes cardiac arrest.
Before we kind of dive into this discussion today about cardiac arrest, I was wondering, could we kind of just define the terms here of, you know, what is meant by cardiac arrest? Because it's something that, like, it seems pretty simple, but then when you get into, you know, the four different kinds of arrest that we see, it doesn't completely make sense to me that we call some things arrest that we do. How can you explain cardiac arrest?
Well, I think the one thing that a lot of people get tripped up on is we kind of still classify some things under the cardiac arrest banner, but the heart is still doing something. So like VFib, ventricular fibrillation, the cardiac muscle cells are still functioning. They're just not talking to each other anymore. And because they can autonomously beat on their own, they're all just doing their own thing. So my heart's quivering. If we have a pulsus VTach, that's still technically an organized rhythm because I can have a pulse with VTach.
This is where I start to get tripped up.
Well, it's just simply the difference is perfusion. Pulsus VTach, again, I'm not perfusing my vital organs to be able to perform any bodily functions. People that are in VTach, the reason we get so nervous is because it's probably going to become pulseless. But people can have good, strong pulses and talk to you, and you look at them and you go, then you put them on the monitor and you go, holy crap, that looks really bad. It is really bad.
So what is the difference then? How do you go to VTach with a pulse to VTach without a pulse? I mean, I get that it's the difference of perfusion.
The body tries to compensate. So we have a lot of vasoconstriction. VTach is a ventricular driven rhythm. And the ventricles are, their inherent rate is, you know, 20 to 50, 20 to 60-ish. But now I'm in VTach and there's something driving it at 100, 120, 140, but it's not a very effective pumping. And so eventually my body can't compensate for that decreased pumping capacity, that decreased cardiac output, just simply by vasoconstricting, and then it just gives up. And the vasodilation kicks in, and then I just lose my pulse because I don't have any more capacity to have a blood pressure.
That makes sense. So it's just that you can start with a VTach with a pulse, but then because the perfusion is so poor, the heart will eventually start to, and the body will eventually start to decompensate.
Yeah, it's just a decompensation.
Okay. So we've kind of touched on VTach, VFib, and then what is left in the cardiac arrest algorithm here would be the PEA and asystole. Can you talk about PEA? Because that's another, you know, area that I'm pretty fuzzy in. How can there be electrical impulse without a pulse? Like, what's the disconnect here?
Yeah, that one messes people up a lot. So PEA, pulseless electrical activity. I have some electrical activity that appears to be organized in some way, but I have no pulse. Top two reasons for that are hypoxia and hypovolemia. Maybe I have a patient that's got some pretty good heart failure going on. Heart failure is dealing with the muscle So the muscle doesn't have the capacity to really pump very effectively. My electrical pathways might be completely fine. So want to make sure that they're being oxygenated properly, and maybe they just need some volume. And if it's not, and if we don't think it's a volume problem, well, then maybe we need some vasoconstriction to try it, to get more fluid into the core to increase their cardiac output. So PEA messes with people because they go, but wait, that rhythm, that should have something. And then it's like, well, no, the patient has no pulse and they're not breathing. So we have to treat them the same as we would with, you know, except for we're not going to give them electrical therapy at that point. That one, we just have to figure out why is this happening, especially with PEA, because if I have a good electrical rhythm, why is this not pumping?
Right. So let's say, just for an example, if we threw an ART line in patients who are in PEA, and an ART line being an arterial line that will give us real-time blood pressure, are they going to have any kind of blood pressure here?
They might. Their cardiac output might just be, I mean, you know, we've got to have a blood pressure of at least 40 systolic to even feel a carotid pulse. So if they're less than that, I may not feel pulses, but they might have some cardiac output. And an ART line would show me that, but it's still not enough to perfuse me.
Okay. So maybe in some ways you could think of PEA as like a profound shock state. Would that be a fair statement?
You know, I don't know if anybody would really classify it there. I mean, it kind of is, but shock, we really think of just a systemic, you know, systemic vasodilation. I've just opened up all the pipes throughout my entire body, versus PEA isn't necessarily a circulatory problem as much as it is just a cardiac problem. My heart is not pumping, either not pumping at all, or it's just not pumping efficiently or effectively.
Okay.
So I've never heard anybody put it in that category of a shock, because there is such a thing as cardiogenic shock, but that also has a lot of peripheral vasodilation components with it as well.
Okay. I see what you mean. So you're saying that PEA just designates that your heart has electroactivity, but not pumping in any kind of meaningful way.
Yeah.
Regardless of what's going on systemically with vasodilation, or not being vasodilated.
Yeah. But normally vasodilation kicks in there anyway, just because nothing's being perfused. So that's a pretty common thing when people arrest. Vasodilation is, you know, one of the big ones.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that? To me, that seems confusing. You think that your body would want more meaningful kind of blood pressure, so there would be
constriction. But there's nothing being perfused.
Oh, so there's, got it.
So everything just kind of stops.
Got it. Okay.
So that's why we're always talking about giving a lot of vasoconstrictors and stuff in codes. It's because they're so vasodilated. And so maybe we can change things with some vasoconstriction.
And that's where epi comes in.
Epi, dopamine.
Al, you're helping me put this all together. I love it. This is so great.
I don't feel like this warrants much more explanation, since Al just really laid it all out. In short, I'll just say I found that his explanation of compensation versus decompensation has really helped me to view code situations more holistically. So moving on from BLS to the ICU, if there was one podcast episode that changed my practice the most, it would certainly be episode 25, The Awake and Walking ICU with Callie Dayton. Callie is on a crusade to change the ICU culture to one of early mobilization and less sedation. I could really sing her praises all day, but I'm going to step back and let her take it from here.
What do you mean by an awake and walking ICU?
That's a great question. My definition is an ICU that allows patients to wake up right after intubation and to stay awake throughout their time in the ventilator, with some exceptions. So intubation is a procedure, and sedation is perfect for procedures. We give it for colonoscopies, medications like propofol, we give it for surgeries, and used in the short term for brief periods of time, sedation is magical, right? They don't feel anything. They don't remember anything. It makes it actually essential for certain procedures. So we can give sedation for intubation. We usually give etomidate, propofol, fentanyl, place the breathing tube, but then we allow them to wake up. What is normal outside of this awake and walking ICU is that the second someone's intubated, while they're still sedated from those intubation drugs, habitually they are hanging these other medications like propofol, Versed, fentanyl, and just assuming that they're going to be comatose the rest of the time on the ventilator. Yet where I come from, these patients come out of intubation and it's kind of like waking up from a colonoscopy. They wake up with a little bit of a jolt, right? Where am I? What happened? Often we've explained to them beforehand. We've usually had the opportunity to talk to them before they were intubated to say, you're getting worse. You need support from the ventilator. We're going to place a breathing tube. Here's what it's going to be like. Stay calm. We're going to let you wake up. We have a pen and paper ready for them. They can write. They can ask their questions. They can use a mirror to see their breathing tube, their endotracheal tube. We show them the ventilator. Under normal circumstances, the family is right there talking them through it. And so, yes, the breathing tube is uncomfortable. No one is doing cartwheels on it. No one loves it. And yet it is far more tolerable when they are free from delirium, which we'll get into. So we let them acclimate to the breathing tube. We walk them through the process. We do tie their hands down initially just to make sure that they don't do something crazy while they're confused during that initial phase. But a lot of patients can be unrestrained. They understand what's going on. They actually protect their breathing tube. Waking up from a little bolus of propofol is far different than waking up after days to weeks of propofol. And that's what we need to understand, because in quote normal ICUs, when they've had these medications for prolonged periods of time, then we're telling people to give sedation vacations to wean back the sedation. And we've caused this severe confusion, delirium underneath. And when we wean back the sedation, we unleash it. And we see agitation, anxiety. They're trying to pull out the breathing tube. They're trying to get out of bed. And the assumption is it's because the breathing tube is uncomfortable or the ventilator is uncomfortable. That is a huge misconception. The belief is that patients cannot be awake and tolerant of the endotracheal tube and ventilator.
That's honestly what I have always thought, that if I had a tube in my throat, my instinct would be to pull it out.
Right. But the instinct, when you're allowed to have your coping mechanisms and be oriented and have your bearings and be yourself when you're free of sedation, is to protect your lifeline. Most patients are able to be oriented and calm and compliant, and it makes everything so much easier, which we'll get into. But that's kind of the culture of an awake and walking ICU. One doctor that I interviewed on my podcast that I worked with, he was right off of his fellowship, started in this ICU. So during his fellowship, he was somewhere else. So habitually, after he intubated his first patient in the awake and walking ICU, he turned to the nurse and he said, okay, what do you want for sedation? And this nurse was a seasoned ICU nurse there, understood the objective and looked at him like he had said something insane and said, that's not what we do here. Never say that again. And he was confused, but he came to learn how much easier patient care is and how much better their outcomes are and how possible it is. And so he's now a big advocate, but that was not the culture he was raised in. But it was a nurse saying, no, that's not what's best for the patient, and advocating that made him change his perspective and learn. So from our side, the hyperactive delirium, we definitely notice it, but only 33.3% of patients have hyperactive delirium.
That's it?
That's it. 44.5% have hypoactive delirium. And then 22.2% have a mixed delirium. But what happens when you have a hyperactive patient? We sedate them. We give the very thing that probably caused the delirium in the first place, because we think it's going to make them more comfortable, right? This whole myth that the more comfortable a patient looks, the more comfortable they are. That's manifested in our sedation practices, I think, in and out of the ICU. Someone's hyperactive, we don't say, oh my goodness, they're in acute brain failure. We need to protect their brains. We say, wow, they're really unruly. We need to sedate them. So we give them Ativan, or we give them Seroquel, or, you know, we give things that are going to put them down. So when they are, quote, sleeping, we figure our job is done and we've done a humane and good thing. But oftentimes we've sent them into hypoactive delirium. And then those medications wear off and they come out thrashing again, and we give it to them again. We lock them into this delirium train. That has so many repercussions. I mean, it prolongs their time in the hospital in general. It doubles their risk of dying in the hospital.
Wow.
It triples their risk of dying within the next 6 months after discharge. And even 1 year after discharge, if they had delirium in the hospital, they're still at a higher risk of dying 1 year after discharge. For every 1 day of delirium, there's a 10% increased risk of death. Yet we don't see it that way. We don't talk about it. We don't say, wow, they're confused. They're combative. They could die. We need to get them out of delirium. We don't have the education. We don't have the time. We don't have the system that supports this culture of, we need to bring them back into reality, keep them safe, implement these interventions that will shorten the duration of delirium so that they can actually come back to functional lives. We also don't understand what it's like for them during delirium. When I talk to ICU survivors and even people that have been on the medical floor having delirium, it haunts me. And I've never had delirium. They're talking about horrific, graphic scenarios that are not appropriately defined by hallucinations or delusions. We use those terms, but after talking to survivors, that's not adequate. These are experiences. They genuinely experience these vivid realities. And that's why it's so traumatizing. They think their kids are kidnapped. I've heard that from a couple of survivors, that they genuinely believe during their delirium that their kids were kidnapped. Now, if that's me, I have three little kids. If I think my kids are kidnapped, you would probably have, like, it would require so much sedation to keep me in bed.
Yeah.
I would be pulling out my endotracheal tube. I'd be pulling out my IVs. I would be ripping my restraints off the bed, and I'm getting myself out of bed, and I'm going to go save my kids. No matter how weak or how sick I am, I'm going to try everything possible to go save my kids if that's my reality. They also think that they're being raped when they're getting a Foley catheter.
Yes.
They think it's genital mutilation.
Ugh.
They think that the breathing tube is a snake down their throats. They think they're kidnapped. They think they're enemy territory. And so when we understand their reality, it will influence us to treat them differently. Instead of they're being so annoying and they're driving me crazy and they just want to shut them up with Ativan, we should be panicked right along with them.
Seriously, since talking to Callie, I have been mobilizing my patients so much more. I've shifted my thinking of mobility from a nice to do to a must do, right along there with giving medications. I've gotten better at calling in the resources, like getting the right equipment and all the staff needed to get it done. I don't wait for PT to see my patient. I'm saying this not because I'm so holier or whatnot. I mobilize my patients because I now know exactly how important this is for good patient outcomes. To wrap it up, my practice over the last couple of years has been influenced a lot by having the discussions I've had on this podcast. Specifically, I've learned to rely more on a patient's wisdom and home supply when managing their ostomies. I'm better at selling the idea of multimodal pain strategy to my patients. I have a clear understanding of what constitutes cardiac arrest beyond a systole, and I mobilize my patients much more and steer clear of benzos as much as possible. I hope that this podcast has helped you improve your nursing practice. I'm going to take a break for the rest of December, but I look forward to releasing episodes starting again in January. If you found value in this podcast, please share it with your fellow nursing friends and colleagues. It really helps me to grow the show and to keep producing these high-value episodes for you. If you would like more practice-improving content in between episodes, follow me on Instagram or Facebook at UpMyNursingGame. Until next time, happy holidays. I hope that you have upped your nursing game.